Jenner on what their roles were in the January 6th investigation. On the mid-air crash in Washington Wednesday of an Army helicopter and a commercial jetliner, investigators say the sources of data do not agree at what altitude the collision happened. This is ABC News. A warning from public health experts that direct primary care is no replacement for insurance. Patients at clinics pay a fee, roughly $50 to $100 a month. They get easier direct access to their doctor for routine care as often as they want for no extra cost, but the monthly fee covers nothing beyond the visits. They're not calling for Dr. Phil or Phil Collins, but Pennsylvania's most famous rodent, Punxsutawney Phil, who saw his shadow and predicted six more weeks of winter today on Woodchuck Day. The cost of hosting a Super Bowl party is expected to barely budge this year, with an average increase of about 10 cents from the previous year, say economists with the Wells Fargo Agri-Food Institute. Celery and broccoli, the best dipping choices since they cost less this year. Salsa and nacho cheese are holding steady. Avocados cost more. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Where are you at with dome stadiums?
Oh, love them. Snow games are awesome, but it's also a risk of injuries and everything.
Give me a dome anytime. I don't want to see elite athletes running on snow like it's me playing out there and tripping and slipping. I want to watch those guys run. I want the receivers to run and catch their passes. I want to see great athletes being great athletes.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us. It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Holler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S., and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear, and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Jerry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm Lisa Hale with WISS News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WISS.FM.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. Wisconsin researchers are studying ways microbes can recycle wastewater into eco-friendly products. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
In the dairy industry, which produces billions of pounds of cheese per year, whey byproducts can be processed with microbes to create products like bioplastics. Declan Roche with Foremost Farms USA, a Wisconsin-based dairy cooperative, says the same idea could apply across industries.
A lot of waste is generated in the processing of any food item. I'm just talking dairy in this instance, but any plant that processes agricultural products generates waste.
Roche adds, overall, the profit is low, but the ultimate goal is to transform how more industries use their waste so it can be cycled back into production. Byproduct waste requires oxygen to break it down, so it can't be dumped into waterways without being pre-treated, or it could affect water quality and harm aquatic animals. Roche explains that's where microbes come in. A microbiologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Erica Majumder, says the idea is to help curb climate change.
We already have extracted so many materials from around the planet that I think it makes sense to reuse what we already have in circulation instead of just depositing things in landfills and digging stuff up.
They say innovations like these that can help to address global waste require scaling up to industrial levels where controlled environments can allow these processes to take place. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll have a chance of some light snow, rain, and freezing rain first part of your day. Then skies eventually turning partly cloudy. Highs in the lower 40s, a west wind developing. Tonight, increasing clouds, some more light snow in upper 20s. Right now, it's 37.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Wisconsin-based comedian Eli Pills and Nightlight frequent flyer, musician, producer, and founder of Wisconsinology.com, Frank Anderson. We're going to light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. This is our weekly weekend review of all things law-related, justice-related, rule of law-related. A lot of focus upon the institutions of government, including in this edition of Amicus Law Review. Things related to the Department of Justice, big changes internally and externally as the Trump appointees and Trump non-appointees, civil servants, change a lot inside the Department of Justice, at Main Justice there on 9th and Constitution in Washington, D.C., but also around the nation as the president, as is his obligation of the Constitution, nominates, again with the appointment of the advice and consent of the Senate, the appointment of U.S. attorneys nationwide. That all happening in this transition period. Right down the street from the Department of Justice is the United States Supreme Court. We turn our attention now in this second hour of Amicus Law Review to that major institution in Washington, D.C. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this second hour of Amicus Law Review. We have talked a lot on this broadcast about the United States Supreme Court because it plays a major role, as you all well know, in who we are in America, making some major decisions about all kinds of things, privacy rights, education rights, environmental issues, agriculture, commerce, labor, you name it, the Supreme Court is involved in the issue. One of the issues, of course, which I encourage listeners to think about is whether or not the Supreme Court now making many of these decisions, and yes, indeed, they come up through litigation. They come in challenges in the courtrooms around our country through the federal and appellate courts, ultimately getting to the Supreme Court. Question whether or not the policy focus on all of these major issues has now been taken over by the United States Supreme Court. Why? Because the other branch, just across the parking lot there on Capitol Hill, it's the Congress. Those are the people inside that wonderfully important building, the cornerstone of our entire democracy, the Capitol, the House of Representatives, the United States Senate, whether those people, the people we send there to decide policy for us, to make these critically important and, yes, difficult and challenging decisions, whether they're doing their jobs. And more as issues related to all kinds of things. Yes, indeed, involving immigration, indeed, involving the status of a president to uphold or not uphold the federal decisions of the Congress when it comes to spending and federal programs, all of those kinds of things ending up in our courts, including ultimately the Supreme Court, because more and more, and this has been the history, of course, in recent times, our Congress cannot and apparently does not decide these major issues. I would offer to you that as you read the Federalist Papers, as you think about the Constitution of our nation and even the Constitution of it with a small c, as we approach in a couple of years here the 250th anniversary of our nation as we know it, whether or not our nation would be recognized by our founding fathers for the incredible amount of power that now exists inside the United States Supreme Court and, of course, at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, and that is in the White House. We've talked a lot about that as well. In between those two buildings, of course, is the U.S. Department of Justice. That's a part of the executive branch. It is not an independent branch of government. It is inside the department. The Department of Justice is inside the executive branch. And it too, again, exercising on behalf of an extremely powerful president, an awful lot of authority. The question we raise as students of civics in America in 2025 here in Wisconsin and throughout our nation is, where is our Congress? Now, plainly, they get a lot of attention. They get a lot of attention in terms of recent days confirming nominees. Yes, that's right. Or not confirming them. Doing oversight of various issues. The question is, when it comes to these big ticket items like policy issues having to do with immigration and commerce and labor, yes, and agriculture and all kinds of other things out there, civil rights, this Congress of recent times, this is the 119th Congress, has certainly not been as active in terms of major issues, and instead those falling to a president and presidents, plural, who issue executive orders in absence of congressional action, and yes, more and more to the Supreme Court that decides cases when the Congress is not deciding those as our representatives. So let's talk, as we often do, about the inventory right now before the Supreme Court. Right now, 65 cases pending as of this first weekend in February. 65 cases in which the United States Supreme Court has said, we'll take those cases where they've granted what's called a writ of certiorari. We've talked about that a lot on this broadcast. That's the order, the writ. Four of nine members of the Supreme Court have got to say, yes, indeed. Let's take a look at that lower court case. Let's take a look at that case coming out of a Supreme Court of a state in America. Of that 65, here are the big ticket circuits. The Fifth Circuit, that's Texas and Louisiana and Alabama. Lots of focus on the Fifth Circuit these days. Undeniably the most conservative district in our nation. 14 of the 65 cases coming out of the Fifth Circuit, not surprisingly. Close second, Ninth Circuit, huge geographically, very different politically, to use the small p sense of that word. Five cases coming out of the Ninth Circuit, five cases coming out of the Second Circuit. That's basically New York and adjacent states as well. Lots of population there as well. Seven cases coming out of the Fourth Circuit, four coming out of the Sixth Circuit, four out of the Tenth Circuit, two coming out of our own circuit, the Seventh Circuit, all of those comprising the 65-case docket now in front of our United States Supreme Court. And as we have talked about ever since October 1 of 2024, that's the first day, the first Monday in the new term of the Supreme Court, entertaining oral argument, these opportunities for the parties to come forward through their attorneys, through their lawyers, their representatives, and argue to the court orally, vocally, publicly, in support of their positions. We've seen, of course, the sketches of those because cameras are not allowed in the federal courts. But we've also heard from the justices as they have sparred with the attorneys about the merits and demerits of the issues in front of them. And indeed, just in recent weeks, ever since Donald Trump has been the president, while much of our focus has, yes, been on the Department of Justice, and yes, even more so on all of these actions being undertaken with dizzying flurry coming out of the White House, the Supreme Court has also been busy. Supreme Court entertaining arguments on January 21 and January 22nd, four cases just in recent weeks that are important. We're going to talk about one of those in particular, but let me tell you about what the cases are, again, as a part of our continuing inventory. A case called FDA, Food and Drug Administration, versus R.J. Reynolds. That was decided the day after the inauguration, January 21st. It involves whether a company, sounds pretty wonky, very legal, a company may petition a court in a circuit outside of the company's primary market, that is, outside of places where it does principal business, if it can petition a court outside that company's primary market, another circuit, if another company located within that court's jurisdiction signs onto the petition. That's a lot there, and it's the kinds of things that lawyers love to discuss. The question is whether or not a manufacturer may file a petition for review in a circuit court where it neither resides nor has the principal place of business, having to do with jurisdiction and the capacity of particular courts to decide cases. That's FDA versus R.J. Reynolds. There's another case named McLaughlin Chiropractic Associates versus McKesson. It concerns whether a thing called the Hobbs Act requires a U.S. district court to accept the Federal Communications Legitimate Interpretation of something called the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, whether the Hobbs Act required the district court in this particular case to accept the FCC's legal interpretation of this law. And what does that sound like? That sounds like, yes, once again, the question of whether or not courts should defer to the legitimate, the appropriate, the experienced-based views of a federal agency. How many times have we talked about that issue? How often has that percolated up in the annals of not just this broadcast, but of many people across the country who bemoan the fact that we have now gotten rid of 40 years of tradition when it comes to judges deferring to expertise, deferring to intelligence, deferring to people who know what they're doing. This is another one of those cases. Whether or not a trial judge should look at the FCC and say, you know what, your interpretation of this Telephone Consumer Protection Act makes sense. We should follow it, absent it being totally ridiculous. The question, once again, whether or not the Hobbs Act requires that district court to follow what the lower court has decided when it comes to interpretation, the issue now being applied on a regular basis, and judges more and more feeling free in the wake of the drop kicking, the abandonment of what you recall as the Chevron deference, courts more and more deciding on their own because, according to the Chief Justice, they know best. They know best how these laws should be interpreted, as opposed to the experience-based and justice-based decisions of these agencies. Then there's another case. It was decided, argued, on January 22nd. It's called Cunningham versus Cornell University. It concerns whether Cornell University, in its Retirement Plan Oversight Committee, violated the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. You know that as ERISA, as claimed by one of the employees there, whether a plaintiff can state a claim by alleging that a plan fiduciary engaged in a transaction constituting a furnishing of goods and services, lots of wonky stuff involved in that as well, lots of things involving language under Section 1106 of Title 29 under, that's right, ERISA. It is nonetheless a big issue having to do with labor issues and ERISA in America. That was argued on the 22nd of January. And again, also on the same day, a major case having to do with law enforcement, a case called Barnes versus Felix, concerns whether the moment of threat doctrine, keep that in mind, the moment of threat doctrine should be applied to Fourth Amendment excessive force claims. Questions whether or not courts should apply this moment of threat doctrine when evaluating an excessive force claim under the 14th Amendment. The moment of threat doctrine in law enforcement refers to an inquiry that examines whether officers were in danger of their lives, in danger of their security, at the very moment of the threat that resulted in the officer's use of deadly force. Again, lots to unpack there. Or should that doctrine be abandoned in favor of a more broadly stated analysis of all the facts leading up to and surrounding that use of deadly force? Analysis exclusively focuses on the moment just before the alleged excessive force was used. And so, on the 22nd of January, our Supreme Court entertained argument on exactly that issue. As Amicus Law Review comes back, I'll tell you what the justices seem to be inclined to do when it comes to these excessive force lawsuits and this interesting moment of threat doctrine, which is now before our United States Supreme Court. That as our broadcast continues.
A new choice. The Fox Valley's real news and great conversation. WISS.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. On Monday, January 20th, Donald Trump returned to office, sworn in as the 47th President of the United States. Right out of the gate, he took a number of actions on his top issue, immigration. Perhaps the most troubling of these is one aiming to end birthright citizenship in America. An immigration attorney I talked to told me, "We're going to sit through a lot of BS over the course of the next weeks, months, and years, But this is the big one. My take? This action from the Trump administration is despicable, unconstitutional, and fundamentally anti-American. The day after the order was issued, Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call joined a coalition of 20 states challenging this action in court. This legal battle will be a tremendously important one for all of us to follow.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, the Valley's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Hilario. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for these remaining minutes, this remaining hour of our broadcast here on the stations of Civic Media. Talking necessarily, as we need to do, to understand what our government is doing, what our Supreme Court is doing routinely, talking about the recent cases in front of the United States Supreme Court, some of them the kinds of things that lawyers love to talk about, in the weeds, interpreting things like the Hobbs Act and, yes, other issues like ERISA. Nonetheless, very important for all kinds of people in America. You don't always need to understand the ins and outs of all these things, but it underscores the breadth of the kinds of things that our Supreme Court is taking on in right now these 65 cases pending in front of it, including this issue having to do with the issue of moment of threat, a doctrine, again, that I suspect that many of us have not thought about a lot. All of this started in this particular case on an April afternoon, way back in 2016, when Ashtian Barnes, who's 24 years old, was driving on a highway outside of Houston, Texas, in a car that his girlfriend had rented. He was on his way to pick up her daughter from daycare. That's the premise for the case as it plays out. Although Ashtian Barnes did not know it, the car's license plate that his girlfriend had rented was linked to some unpaid tolls that had been incurred by another driver of that same vehicle. So what happens is there's an officer, his name is Roberto Felix Jr., of the Harris County Constable's Office, pulls the car over based upon those unpaid tolls that are attached to this particular car. Again, Mr. Barnes knows nothing about this because, plainly, the circumstances under which it's rented, he is driving the car. Barnes could not immediately locate his license once Roberto Felix approaches him, and he could also not locate the car's registration. And so the officer asks him to step outside of the car. And instead, Mr. Barnes, Ashtian Barnes, began to pull away. That's his action. He begins to pull away and not do what the officer directed him to do. Probably would have resulted in a very different result had he followed those directions and explained what is going on here. Instead, Ashtian Barnes began to pull away with the car door still open. And here's when the tragedy gets even worse. This is human tragedy of the highest nature, undeniably. Officer Roberto Felix draws his gun. He jumps onto the moving car's door sill and twice shoots Ashtian Barnes. And all this is recorded on the dash cam footage. The mother of Ashtian Barnes, her name is Janice Hughes Barnes, sued. And she says that the officer's use of force was unreasonable and violates the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. This is the mother of the young man who was involved in this horrific incident. He is killed during the course of this horrific event. A unanimous three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, again, that Fifth Circuit, ruled last year in favor of the officer on what it said was a narrow question. Patrick Higginbotham says this. He says, we may only ask under this particular rubric, under this very narrow moment of threat doctrine, whether Officer Felix was in danger at the moment of the threat that caused him to use the deadly force against Barnes. That's what Patrick Higginbotham, one of the judges on the panel in the Fifth Circuit, wrote. He added a concurring opinion, however, And this is significant because it gets to the Supreme Court on this basis. He said had he been allowed to consider all the circumstances surrounding the stop, he could have ruled the other way and gone beyond this moment of threat doctrine to permit a trier of fact to assess everything. The judge instead said, given the rapid sequence of events and Officer Felix's role in drawing his weapon and jumping on the running board, the totality of the circumstances merits finding that Officer Felix violated Barnes' Fourth Amendment right to be free from excessive force. But under the rubric, this particular rubric as to police shootings, the moment of threat doctrine required to go in the opposite direction. At this recent argument, the case is called Barnes versus Felix, some justices expressed concerns about second-guessing the police officer's split-second judgments. That is always a legitimate concern. Brett Kavanaugh said, an officer does not get the time we've spent here today to make that decision. And indeed, officers are required, as we all know, to make these split-second decisions, sometimes catastrophic in nature. But most of the justices on the Supreme Court seemed inclined to allow the court to consider more than the seconds before the shooting, adopting what Judge Higginbotham encouraged them to do, a broader understanding of the law. Sam Alito said this, would you be satisfied with a narrow holding that is wrong for a court to look just at the moment of the threat? The lawyer said he would, and he said, though he added, it would be helpful if the court makes clear that means that you can look at the jump in addition to the shoot. A lawyer for Officer Felix said the court should narrow its focus to the moment he used force, and that lawyer arguing he was clinging to the side of a fleeing suspect's car, and Felix reasonably believed that his life was in imminent danger. That conclusion, the lawyer for Officer Felix said, should end the case. In rebuttal, again, the lawyer on the other side said, you have to look at the whole picture, and here, that's more than just 2 seconds. The case arose, again, from this commonplace occurrence, a routine traffic stop in America, again, ending in the death of an unarmed black man in this case. The questions for the justices now, how closely should courts consider and confine this analysis to the moment of truth rather than the larger context? It appeared the Supreme Court seemed ready to reject that limit on these excessive force Fourth Amendment suits. There was something of a consensus that that theory was now too narrowly focused in the seconds preceding this shooting. And indeed, Neil Gorsuch says, everybody agrees it's wrong. What's the harm of saying that? And the question now, which we'll wait for in June, maybe May, maybe June, maybe July, is what is it that this standard, what the standard, how is this going to look like? What is this, the Supreme Court going to tell us now is the standard? If it's not the moment of threat, what is the more expansive nature of the analysis that should, in fact, be applied in these kinds of minute-type decisions, these instances where tragedy happens when we have confrontations between law enforcement officers and citizens in America? That case, once again, going to tell us much about that. Barnes versus Felix, as the Supreme Court decides that case and many others on its 65-docket caseload in May and June. More about the Supreme Court as Amicus Law Review continues.
This is the Civic Media Radio Network. From Oshkosh to Nina, this is 98.3 WISS.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Quebec has joined the number of Canadian provinces pulling American alcohol from shelves as soon as tariffs take effect on Tuesday. Prices of many goods could go up under the tariffs slapped by President Trump on imports from China, Mexico, and Canada. Those nations putting tariffs on U.S. goods in response. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer says he doesn't like tariffs.
The good news is there are a good number of Republicans who don't like them either. And so I'm hopeful we can get bipartisan legislation to prevent the president from raising these tariffs, or once he does, to roll them back.
Sources tell ABC News that potentially thousands of FBI employees got an emailed questionnaire on what their roles were in the January 6th investigation. On the mid-air crash in Washington Wednesday of an Army helicopter and a commercial jetliner, investigators say the sources of data do not agree at what altitude the collision happened. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
A blockbuster trade shakes up the NBA. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cuska with Civic Media Sports. The NBA was rocked by a major trade last night as the Los Angeles Lakers swapped Anthony Davis for Luka Doncic of the Dallas Mavericks in a three-team, seven-player deal. It's the first time that a midseason trade has included two players named All-NBA in the previous season. Tonight, the Milwaukee Bucks will try to avoid their third straight loss as they take on the Memphis Grizzlies. The Bucks have now fallen to fifth place in the Eastern Conference. Tip time is at 7:30. College hoops, it was the Wisconsin Badgers rallying in the second half to take down Northwestern 75-69 yesterday. John Tonjay led the 17th-ranked Badgers with 27 points in the win, which puts Wisconsin in a three-way tie for fourth place in the Big Ten. Wisconsin will get Indiana on Tuesday night in Madison. Then it was a top 25 showdown in Milwaukee last night on National Marquette Day. 9th-ranked Marquette never led against number 25 UConn, with UConn leading by as many as 22 points in a 77-69 win. Cam Jones had 22 points for Marquette, which will play at St. John's on Tuesday. For Civic Media Sports, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll have a chance of some light snow, rain, and freezing rain first part of your day. Then skies eventually turning partly cloudy. Highs in the lower 40s, a west wind developing. Tonight, increasing clouds, some more light snow in upper 20s. It's 39 at our studios.
Hey, it's John Mino.
And Jim Schmidt from Mino and the Mayor.
Want to stay in the loop with all things Northeast Wisconsin? Sign up for the WISS weekly newsletter.
Get the latest local stories, updates on the weather, and a special feature from our Mino and the Mayor podcast.
It's your one-stop shop for real news and great conversation in Northeast Wisconsin.
Log on to WISS.FM today and get signed up.
Real news, great conversation. Get signed up today at WISS.FM/newsletter.
Nerds, it's time to come together. I'm Amanda Nimmer, bringing you your new Wisco 411, and this is your time to rise, because one of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming February 1st through April 27th, showcasing iconic characters, vehicles, memorable scenes from the franchise. There are 142 collected items, including a life-size land speeder. Get your tickets for the Multicultural Center's Unofficial Galaxies from February till the end of April.
Hey there, folks. It's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute and a tip about saving money when you are renting a car. So you know how you get to the rental counter and then they ask you if you want to prepay for gas so you don't have to bring the car back full? Well, I used to get sweaty in those moments as I wasn't sure what the right money choice was. Prepaying for gas at the rental counter? Not worth it. First off, rental companies often charge more per gallon on the prepay than local gas stations do at the pump. And even if they're about equal, fees or taxes on your rental can tip the scales against prepaying. And you'd have to return that car completely empty to get the full value of buying prepaid gas. Otherwise, you're just buying gas for Avis and Budget or whoever. Quick note, make sure you have time to refill the tank before you return the rental. If you don't prepay and you don't fill up, they are going to charge you like they have refilled that car with liquid gold. For more tips, head to workmoney.org. Till next time, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll take a look back at the weekend happenings and have an all-new What's Worse. Your chance to call in, have your voice heard. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this second hour of our weekend broadcast on law, and in particular the United States Supreme Court. We know that in addition to those oral arguments that have followed the inauguration of our president on January 21 and January 22nd, the Supreme Court has also got more oral arguments scheduled in many other cases coming up in February and March. We know that there are four oral arguments between February 24th, 25th, and 26th. Four more oral arguments between March 3rd and 5th. Lots of things going on in the Supreme Court. You can listen in on those oral arguments as they happen, and you can also pull up the recorded oral arguments for your review, for your assessment. You can hear the justices themselves talk about these cases. You can hear the things that I quote to you in this broadcast as they come out of the mouths of the justices, including Neil Gorsuch and including Sam Alito and others on the bench. All of that, again, going to be a part of our continuing analysis of our Supreme Court. Along the way, from time to time, as you know well, the Supreme Court also does other things. It decides to take or not take certain cases, and thereby determining whether or not they can, the laws that are challenged, the actions that are challenged, continue to stand. If the Supreme Court takes a case, it may well signal that they're going to return with decisions that may reverse a lower court. It may reverse an action by the executive branch or another portion of government. But if the Supreme Court decides not to take a case or decides to do something without providing reasons, that also has an impact upon the way that we understand the law in America. So let's talk about something else that sounds very wonky and very lawyerish, and it is indeed a thing called the Corporate Transparency Act of 2021. Supreme Court recently, just this past week or so, revived this federal law. What does it do? It requires companies to report information about their owners in an effort to combat things like money laundering, the drug trade, and terrorism. The Supreme Court basically revives this law that's meant to fight money laundering after some lower court actions, which I'll describe now. The court's brief order, no reasons at all, typical when the justices act on these emergency applications. This is sometimes called their shadow docket. Once again, we don't get reasoned opinions as we do in those many cases coming out in May and June, where we've got tomes of things written by the concurring justices and dissenting justices. Here, the ruling without any particular reasons, but nonetheless upholding and reviving a law that is meant to fight money laundering, among other things. The ruling is what's called provisional. It reinstates the law while a challenge to it at the lower courts move forward. Critics of the Corporate Transparency Act of 2021, and this is where this all comes about, say it's needlessly burdensome. And by virtue of what it requires in under the law, it's a threat to privacy and an unconstitutional federal intrusion, they say, on matters that have been historically regulated by the states. This is a state interest, they say, not the federal government. You're way overreaching here. Congress shouldn't do this. No authority to pass this kind of legislation. The challenge to the law brought by a firearms dealer, a technology company, a dairy, and the Libertarian Party of Mississippi, also the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which was the lead plaintiff in the first major challenge to the Affordable Care Act as well. In that case, you may recall the plaintiffs in the challenge to the transparency law argued that the Constitution's Commerce Clause did not authorize Congress to regulate what they said was inaction rather than in economic activity. So a lot of these issues, once again, being revisited in this challenge to the law. The challengers here noting the law covers tens of millions of very small businesses, small entities out there, including homeowners associations and family trusts. They said that complying with the law will collectively cost tens of billions of dollars. We can't suffer that, they said. And in addition, it's way beyond the capacity of Congress to act. And again, consistent with how they've argued before, Supreme Court, they said, should strike this down. At a lower court, the Federal District Court in Texas, a judge named Amos Mazzant, M-A-Z-Z-A-N-T, he blocked the law nationwide, saying that Congress had overstepped its constitutional authority. Though seemingly benign, he said, this federal mandate marks a drastic twofold departure from history. First, he said it represents a federal attempt to monitor companies created under state law. a matter that our federalist system has left almost exclusively to the several states. He's buying into that states' rights theory. And second, he said the CTA, again, the law here, the Consumer Corporate Transparency Act, the CTA ends a feature of corporate formation as designed by those various states. Again, using that concept. And that concept is anonymity. He said, for good reason, plaintiffs fear this flanking quasi-Orwellian statute and its implications on our dual system of government. The lower court judge, the federal district court judge in Texas, blocking the law, saying it cannot be enforced. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals, here we come, for the Fifth Circuit, temporarily lifted that injunction, observing, and they said, this three-judge panel, the ownership and operation of a business are economic activities. A reporting requirement for entities engaged in these economic activities falls within a century of the Supreme Court's Commerce Clause jurisprudence. Nothing wrong with this at all. That's the first three-judge panel. It was divided. And a different three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit later reverses course, and it blocks the law while the appeal moves forward. Arguments for the Fifth Circuit are scheduled for late March. Following all of that, it's a lot. Once again, it's a lot to consume. You've got judges there, lower court judges, district court judges, appellate court judges, going in opposite directions on this legitimate issue about whether or not Congress, in its economic activity rubric, can in fact pass this kind of legislation, or whether or not it's so burdensome and invades the anonymity, as the lower court judge said, that it is indeed Orwellian in nature and therefore should be stricken down. So what does the Supreme Court do just recently? The Supreme Court basically says the law can continue to be in effect while the lower courts, including the Fifth Circuit, continues to argue about all of this. A major argument coming up again in March about this. But in the meantime, the Corporate Transparency Act, again, blocked by a federal judge. Supreme Court reviving that federal law, requiring companies to report this information about their owners to combat money laundering and other things like terrorism and drugs out there. Again, the limited order here, without any reasons, without clear statements, a part of the docket of the Supreme Court when they review these kinds of things on emergency applications changes the law, right? It changes the way that the law will be applied. Right now, the Corporate Transparency Act is still alive, awaiting further oral argument in the Fifth Circuit, certainly going to be returning to the Supreme Court ultimately one day to decide this contested issue. Reasonable people on both sides saying you can't do this. Supreme Court obviously determining for now that they want to hear more from the lower courts before deciding on what to do here. Also a part of the work and the mission of our Supreme Court. Again, we live in a nation where not only can and do reasonable litigants disagree, but they've got this amazing opportunity to petition to our highest courts, including circuit courts, yes, including the Fifth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit and the Second Circuit and all the courts around our country. And indeed, they can also seek review, if not obtain review, by the United States Supreme Court. They can ask the court to review the lower court decisions. The Supreme Court plainly cannot, does not take all of the appeals sent to it, and therefore does what is called denying that writ of certiorari, as to many people who are dissatisfied with lower court judgments. Here, likely the Supreme Court will take this one up, grant a writ of certiorari after the Fifth Circuit is completely done with it. In this instance, telling the lower court, you entertain your oral argument, you go ahead and do this. In the meantime, the law stays in effect for not only Texas, not only the Fifth Circuit, for all the rest of us who are responsible for abiding by the law of the United States of America. We've talked a lot about that in recent days, recent times, when we invoke once again the requirement of our Constitution that says that the President of the United States of America has got to take care that the laws of our nation be faithfully executed. That language being used more and more by federal district court and presumably one day appellate court judges in addressing many of the kinds of things that the Trump administration is doing these days, not only in connection with financial programs, federal funding programs, a judge, again, stopping that from happening ultimately, maybe the White House rescinding those bans on the expenditure of federal monies for all kinds of programs out there, still a little bit murky in terms of what the White House has and has not done. Another court, as we know well, a district court in Washington saying that the approach of the president when it comes to birthright citizenship, that first sentence of the 14th Amendment, that can stand. He says it's undeniably unconstitutional what the president has done. And all of that invoking this notion that the president is required to abide by the law as established by the Congress, as, yes, executed by the executive branch, but nonetheless following the law, taking care that the laws of our nation be faithfully executed. All of that going on inside the rubric, inside the standards of our United States Supreme Court. We know as well that there are other things going on in the federal courts of America. We're going to talk about more of that right now. We have talked in the past about the role of the Department of Justice in a nonpartisan, apolitical way of charging and, yes, seeking the convictions of people regardless of their partisan views, their political affiliations. We know that under the Biden administration, for example, there was a prosecution of the president's own son on gun charges, on tax charges. Now, as the president's son was convicted and then facing sentencing, we know well that the former president, also pardoned his son. Lots of controversy about that. Lots of controversy about all the pardons issued by Joe Biden and by Donald Trump in recent days. And we've talked about a lot of the merits and demerits of the use of that pardon power. But we know that all of that comes in the wake of a Department of Justice that should be apolitical, that should be premised upon what the facts of cases show and what grand juries and what investigations lead to in terms of charges against individuals. We know that in the prior administration, that a person named Robert Menendez, the New Jersey's former senator, was charged by this process under the Biden administration Department of Justice by a grand jury convened again by the courts, the grand jury, of course, an entity of the United States court. Robert Menendez charged with violations of federal law. Robert Menendez, a Democrat, a powerful longtime senator, convicted last year on federal bribery and corruption charges. We know that well. We know exactly what this was all about and the nature of the charges presented in a federal court in Manhattan. The course of that trial, again, indicted 16 months ago while Menendez was serving as the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, one of the most powerful perches in Washington, D.C. As a result of all of that prosecution, the prosecution against Menendez, ultimately Menendez found guilty of those federal bribery and corruption charges. And just recently, Robert Menendez, as a part of our process in our federal system, afforded to everyone, every defendant, including Robert Menendez, including Donald Trump, in a different setting, a different court, that court in Manhattan 3 weeks ago. Robert Menendez appearing in a courtroom, a federal courtroom also in Manhattan, to receive his sentence imposed by Judge Sidney Stein. He's a federal district court judge there in the Southern District of New York for the violations of law for which he was convicted. And that process, again, is something that every defendant in America is exposed to as a part of our routine process of the administration of justice. We can comment about this. We can disagree about these kinds of things. But we all need to embrace the notion that our system is premised upon this kind of process. And as Amicus Law continues, we want to tell you about what Sidney Stein, the federal district court judge, said in that sentencing of Robert Menendez, also a part of the rule of law in our nation. And then we'll also talk about another aspect of the rule of law having to do with yet another character in our national history, our national recency, named Rudy Giuliani. All of that as Amicus Law continues.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, home for the Maggie Dawn Show.
Do you hear that? Asthma triggers are everywhere, from dust mites, pet dander, and pollen, to smog and smoke. An asthma attack can strike anywhere, anytime. Be prepared with quick-acting Primatene Mist. Clinically proven to open airways quickly. It's the number one FDA-approved asthma inhaler available over-the-counter. Primatene Mist. Breathe easy again. Use as directed.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot.
Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh, well, that's how the original series was. When they moved the camera, whenever it's like the red alert. The,
right.
Yeah. That was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like.
Right. Lean left. Great. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday nights, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, the Fox Valley's home of Mino and the Mayor.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. This is our final segment of this two-hour program, talking now about two cases in which the federal system works. Regardless of how you think about the results of the justice system with respect to Robert Menendez and Rudy Giuliani, appropriate for all of us under our First Amendment to be able to talk about these things in public. That's one of the other joys and delights and honors of our nation, where we can talk and even disagree about these things, but all embracing the notion that there is a process. And that process includes a trial in which you are presumed innocent until a jury finds you guilty, if at all. And then after that, a sentencing that's conducted by a federal district court judge or a state district court judge, a trial court judge, presumably, who has heard the evidence and can impose a just sentence. At the trial of Robert Menendez, you may recall, jurors were told how Menendez secretly drafted a letter on behalf of Egyptian officials who were hoping for millions more in military aid from the United States, shared some sensitive details about U.S. embassy personnel in Cairo, also attempted to interfere with state and federal criminal prosecutions in New Jersey on behalf of various allies. An extraordinary trial. In the end, the federal district court judge just this past week imposing an 11-year sentence, an 11-year federal sentence upon former Senator Robert Menendez. The judge saying this, he says, "You were successful and powerful. And before announcing the penalty, the judge went on to say, you stood at the apex of our political system somewhere along the way. I don't know where it was." This is the judge speaking. "You lost your way. Working for the public good became working for your good. Your good." That's what Judge Sidney Stein said as a result of this. During the course of the proceeding, former Senator Menendez was there with his sister, both of his children, sitting directly behind him. As the sentencing concluded, of course, he lingered somewhat in the courtroom. He grasped the knees, on one knee on a chair, and as he grasped his children's hand, then he headed out to address a crowd of reporters. And in the public arena, he was not nearly as chastened as he was appearing in front of the judge. When Robert Menendez was speaking directly to the judge as a part of this process, his right of allocution, he described himself as a chastened man who had suffered the ignominy of a guilty verdict and the resignation of a Senate seat. He said, "Every day I'm awake as a punishment. I ask," he said, "you to temper your sort of justice and mercy for a lifetime of duty." And it was after that, of course, the judge imposed this 11-year sentence. Publicly, the senator, after embracing his children in the courtroom, went out into the public and offered a scathing indictment of the justice system and what appeared to be a direct appeal to, yes, President Trump, who has the power to pardon him. The president has given no indication, of course, that he would entertain that pardon for former Senator Menendez. But Menendez said this publicly. Let me just say this. He said, "This whole process has been nothing but a political witch hunt." He said, "President Trump is right. This process is political and it's corrupted to the core. I hope President Trump cleans up the cesspool and restores the integrity of the system." Again, Daniel Sassoon, whose name we heard before earlier in this broadcast, said in a statement that the sentencings of Menendez and two of the co-defendants send a clear message about justice. She said they send a clear message that attempts at any level of government to corrupt the nation's foreign policy and the rule of law will be met with just punishment. Lots and lots of debate in the wake of this, in the midst of this, about what happened to Bob Menendez. At a minimum, they need to embrace the process that resulted in a very strong sentence, 11 years in federal prison for this violation of the public trust, and a process coming to its conclusion or its near conclusion, because, again, Robert Menendez is going to appeal this. He has already indicated he's going to appeal this. In the meantime, the court has allowed Menendez to remain free on bond pending that appeal. He also delayed the start of the sentence until early June so that he could attend the trial of his wife, which you may recall is also facing like charges in all of this. Lots of procedural history yet to come. Menendez not yet surrendering that for that term of imprisonment because of his interest in appealing, as he is right to do under our system, to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Arguably, one day perhaps reaching the Supreme Court, unlikely they would grant certiorari in that case, but all of those avenues in our system open to a defendant now sentenced and exercising his right to appeal that judgment to a higher court. In another court, Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, grilled for hours in federal court after missing several deadlines and handing over $11 million of his prized possession to those two poll workers who he defamed after the 2020 election. He previously avoided being held in contempt of court, but recently Giuliani settled all of this. He keeps some of his property in settlement of that defamation case, an agreement allowing the former mayor of New York City to keep his apartments and some other valuables that were subject of all of this dispute in return for an undisclosed payment to those two election workers who he defamed after the 2020 election. He reached this settlement with those two Georgia election workers. You may recall that he repeatedly defamed them by saying that they compromised the votes in Georgia. The former mayor, as a result of that, found civilly liable for defaming the two of them. He was at risk of losing millions of dollars worth of personal mementos, valuables, real estate that he had gathered over his decades practicing law and then in public office. He had previously been ordered to pay down about $11 million of, yes, that's right, the $148 million judgment he owed the election workers, their names, Ruby Friedman and Shea Moss, a part of the history of this litigation. Good for them in not only enforcing this judgment, ultimately settling it for an undisclosed amount. That is also a part of our system of justice in America. Join us again next weekend as we continue to address things in the courts of America, in the halls of justice in America, here on Amicus Law Review and the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Welcome to the Fox Valley's Real News and Great Conversation, WISS.
Dom Selvia.
Next time, our favorite Delano Democrat, Harvey K., joins to reflect on the legacy of the birthday boys, Thomas Paine and FDR. Also, will tariffs on Canada and Mexico lower prices for Wisconsinites? Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
My part-time service in the Army National Guard makes it possible for me to be more for the community I call home. My training helps me at work when I lead by example. My service in the Army National Guard allows me to keep my community and those I care about safe from threats. Learn more about how you too can live and serve part-time close to home by visiting NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. This is WISS Berlin Oshkosh and WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's Real News and Great Conversation, a Civic Media station.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. On the possibility of Canadians boycotting U.S. goods because of the tariffs President Trump has slapped on imports from Canada, Mexico, and China, Canadian Ambassador to the U.S. Kirsten Hillman.
I don't think anybody will need to tell Canadians what to do. I think that they will make their decisions on their own.
Here's what Canadians are doing so far: booing the American national anthem at pro sporting events in Canada, basketball and hockey. Also, provinces where over three quarters of Canadians live are pulling American alcohol from sale. Mexico's president really ticked at the U.S. president's allegation that Mexico's government is allied with drug cartels. Tariffs routinely are passed on to consumers in high prices, Mexico and Canada announcing their own tariffs on U.S. goods. Of Canada's trade surplus with the U.S., President Trump writes on social media, "We don't need anything they have." This is ABC News. With a lot of the Gaza Strip destroyed buildings and urban rubble, the Israeli military says it destroyed more than a dozen buildings in the West Bank this weekend. The town of Jenin, a militant stronghold, Israeli army says the buildings were used by terrorists. The freeze placed by the Trump administration on federal funding makes it tough for child care providers that partly depend on the federal dollars to keep up with an increase in business at places like Liz Levitt-Lotte's child care service in Maple Grove, Minnesota.
Sometimes we're lucky and we have a spot that we can add them in. Most of the time, that's not the case. So when people call us and they say, "Hey, I need care starting next week," okay, we're full. We could start 3 months from now. And they're like, "That's not going to work."
Faye Vincent, who became an unexpected baseball commissioner in 1989 following the death of